K1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Dan Friedel, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, the United Nations estimates that half of Somalia's population, about 7.7 million people, will require humanitarian assistance and protection in 2022. The UN is asking for $1.5 billion to assist 5.5 million of those considered most at risk. Many years of conflict, severe weather, disease, and increasing poverty have badly harmed the lives of people in Somalia. Many are facing severe hunger. The country faces a famine because of a lack of rainfall for a third year straight. Adam Abdulmullah is the UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Somalia. He says 80% of the country is affected by drought. He told VOA that 169,000 people have left their homes in search of water, food, and land for their farm animals. "When I visited the countryside, I saw many dead animals," he said. "The people I met with, and the elderly people I met with, told me they had not seen this level of drought since the 1970s and 80s. Abdulmullah said Somalia has been overlooked because of developing crises in other parts of the world, especially in the Tigray area of northern Ethiopia and in Afghanistan. He added that the international community would be making a big mistake were it to overlook Somalia. Abdulmullah said that in the 1990s, Somalia faced similar mass migration, starvation, and famine. He also noted the rise of the Al-Shabaab militant group, political unrest, and widespread illegal trade during that time. Recent estimates suggest that drought could force up to 1.4 million Somalis to leave their homes in the next 6 months. That number is in addition to the nearly 3 million people already displaced by conflict and natural disasters. Abdulmullah says at least 1.2 million children under the age of 5 are likely to be severely malnourished in 2022. He warns that about 300,000 children are at risk of dying without immediate assistance.
Ancient bells and organ pipes from the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem gave researchers the idea to recreate music as it may have sounded almost 800 years ago. David Catalunya, a researcher from the universities of Oxford, England, and Würzburg, Germany, is leading a project to build copies of the instruments. Catalunya said that mid-13th century soldiers, known as crusaders, buried the 13 bronze bells near the church because they were worried that the instruments might be destroyed. "They covered the instruments in animal fat to protect them from rust," he said. Catalunya described recreating the bells as a very long process. With early research complete, he estimates it will take about 5 years to make fully usable copies. Meanwhile, a touch of the hand is enough to bring a clear, high-pitched sound from the originals. The custody of the Holy Land for the Roman Catholic Church holds the rare objects and recently showed them to the Reuters news agency. It's half of the original sound, which was much richer and louder and a little bit lower, Catalunya said. The bells were part of a set that played while people sang inside the church, said Franciscan friar Father Stefan, the custody's liturgist. A liturgist leads church members in ritual prayer. The bells were discovered in the early 20th century, along with 222 medieval copper pipes from the Church of the Nativity's organ, Father Stefan said. He added that the discovery happened during a building project at the church's Franciscan compound. The collection also includes the scepter of the Bishop of Bethlehem and candlesticks from the 12th century, which, Catalunya said, were made in France. This suggests a shared source with the bells and organ pipes, which Father Stefan says are the oldest in Christendom. Father Stefan said he hoped the collection would be displayed and played at a Jerusalem museum the custody plans to open by 2024. He used the term significant, meaning very important, when talking about the bells. These bells are very significant for us because they are the bells of Bethlehem and a symbol of nativity in the Christian world, he said. I'm John Russell.
Scientists drilled a small deep hole in the Goldfields Esperance area of Western Australia and found a true millipede. The word millipede means 1,000 feet, but until now, no insect had ever been found with that many legs or feet. The millipede in Australia had 1,306 legs. The scientists are calling it Eumillipes Persephone. Paul Merrick studies insects for Virginia Tech University. He is the lead author of a study recently published in Scientific Reports. Merrick's co-writer is Bruno Buzzato, a biologist in Perth, Australia. He called the discovery a stunning animal, a marvel of evolution. The name means true 1,000 feet and uses the name of Persephone, the queen of the underworld in Greek mythology. The scientists said one of the females had 1,306 legs, another had 998. The males did not have as many legs. Scientists said the number of legs is not always the same because the insects molt, which means to lose their outer layer as they grow. They add more legs throughout their lives. The writers said the insects need all the legs to move through small openings in the deep soil. They live about 60 meters underground and are about 95 millimeters long with a width of less than 1 millimeter. Until now, the longest known millipede was from California. It had 750 legs. I'm Dan Friedel.
The year 2021 saw some important developments in the exploration of Mars, as well as a rise in American-based space tourism. In February, the American space agency NASA announced that its Mars Explorer, Perseverance, landed successfully on the red planet. Perseverance is on a mission to collect Martian soil and rocks as part of a search for signs of ancient life. Perseverance landed in an area of Mars called Jezero Crater. Scientists believe the area contains a large ancient lake bed. NASA considers the area a promising place to find possible signs of microbial life. Scientists believe if life ever existed on Mars, it would have been present 3 to 4 billion years ago, when water flowed on the planet. Perseverance is NASA's fifth rover to explore Mars. Perseverance carried to Mars a small experimental helicopter named Ingenuity. In April, NASA announced Ingenuity had successfully completed a takeoff and landing on the planet. It said the flight was historic. It marked the first time any aircraft had performed a powered, controlled flight on another planet. Ingenuity was meant to demonstrate such flights are possible. NASA says similar helicopters and other aircraft could be used in the future to assist astronauts in search and collection operations. Only a few test flights were planned, but the Ingenuity team said the first ones were so successful that they decided to extend the number of experimental flights. So far, Ingenuity has completed at least 17 flights, with flights progressing in length and distance. This year, both China and the United Arab Emirates sent their first spacecraft to Mars. In May, China announced that its Tianwen-1 spacecraft had successfully landed on Mars after a 7-month trip. The vehicle landed at Utopia Planitia, a large flat area in the northern half of the planet. The six-wheeled explorer is studying the planet's surface soil and atmosphere in search for signs of ancient life. The UAE's Hope probe spacecraft was sent to an extremely high orbit to study Mars. The Emirates' Mars mission aims to study atmospheric and weather conditions around Mars. Among other things, it seeks to help scientists understand how hydrogen and oxygen react in the planet's upper atmosphere. In February, scientists announced they had created a new map that aims to identify the best sources of water on Mars. Water is considered a critical resource to support future exploration activities on Mars. The map identifies two specific areas on Mars where subsurface ice could likely be found. In July, British billionaire Richard Branson launched into space on a rocket plane built by Virgin Galactic, the space tourism company he created. Branson joined two pilots and three other mission specialists on the flight. Virgin Galactic aims to fly private citizens to the edge of space to experience a few minutes of weightlessness and observe Earth. A little over a week later, American billionaire Jeff Bezos flew to the edge of space on a rocket built by his company, Blue Origin. Three other people took the quick trip with him: Bezos' brother, a Dutch teenager, and an 82-year-old pilot. The flights by Branson and Bezos officially launched a new industry that promises any citizen the chance to visit space. Such trips will be costly, however. Virgin Galactic's price for a single flight is $250,000. Blue Origin has not publicly announced its price. Both businesses have established operating bases called spaceports in rural areas of the U.S. And earlier this month, Japanese billionaire Yusaku Maezawa arrived for a 12-day stay at the International Space Station. The businessman arrived along with an assistant aboard a Russian Soyuz spacecraft. The price of that trip has not been made public, but some reports say it cost up to $50 million. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the presidential election of 1888, one issue that played a major part was tariffs. At that time, import taxes were high on many products. The high tariffs protected American goods from competing with lower-priced foreign imports. The tariffs protected millions of jobs in American industry. Not everyone, however, supported high tariffs. The President of the United States, Grover Cleveland, decided that high tariffs were wrong. He told other Democratic leaders that he would try to get the tariffs reduced. The politicians warned him not to try. They said he would only lose the support of business people. They said he would need campaign money from business if he expected to be elected president again. But Cleveland rejected their advice. Shirley Griffith and Ray Freeman tell about the presidential election of 1888.
President Cleveland believed that high tariffs hurt more Americans than they protected. High tariffs, he said, led to high prices on all products. He also opposed high tariffs because they brought in more money than the government needed. The extra money was kept in the public treasury, and this, Cleveland believed, slowed the American economy. The president's Democratic Party united to support his policy of lowering tariffs. When the party held its presidential nominating convention in 1888, delegates quickly renominated Cleveland.
At the Republican Party convention, delegates were expected to nominate Senator James Blaine. Blaine had been the party's candidate 4 years earlier. He had lost to Cleveland in a very close election. Senator Blaine publicly criticized the president's policy on tariffs. He said he looked forward to a full debate on the issue. Republicans thought this meant that Blaine wanted to be nominated for president again. They told him he was sure to win. They said it would be such an easy victory that he would not have to campaign.
In fact, Blaine did not want the nomination. He asked that his name not be put before the convention. He met with reporters to talk about his decision. He said, "A man who has once been the candidate of his party and defeated owes it to his party not to be a candidate again." Many Republicans refused to accept Blaine's decision. They felt that if Blaine were nominated, he would run. Blaine replied, "If the presidential nomination is offered to me, I could not and would not accept it." That was final. Blaine's supporters had to find someone else to nominate for president.
Fourteen men declared themselves to be candidates for the Republican nomination. A leading candidate was Senator John Sherman of Ohio. Another was former Senator Benjamin Harrison of Indiana. Convention delegates voted several times. No man received enough votes to win the nomination. Then a message came from James Blaine. It said, "Nominate Harrison." On the eighth vote, the delegates did. Benjamin Harrison was the grandson of the ninth President of the United States, William Henry Harrison. Benjamin was a lawyer. He had been a general in the Union Army during America's Civil War of the 1860s.
After nominating Harrison, the Republicans approved a strong policy statement on the tariff question. The statement said, "We fully support the American system of protection. President Cleveland and his party serve the interests of Europe. We would support the interests of America. We would see all other taxes ended before we surrender any part of the protective tariff system."
Benjamin Harrison's campaign was well organized. His campaign workers went to businessmen who had become rich because of high protective tariffs. They asked for support, and the businessmen gave millions of dollars to the campaign. The businessmen also put pressure on the people who worked for them. They warned workers that if Cleveland were reelected, there might be no more jobs. Republican Party leaders took an active part in the campaign of 1888. They made speeches and led parades across the country. The party also printed millions of pamphlets that warned against what it called Cleveland's free trade policies.
Grover Cleveland's campaign was not well organized. It started slowly. It did not raise much money. No effort was made to answer Republican attacks on the tariff issue. And the president himself refused to campaign. He said he had more important things to do. The Democrats also failed to stop the Republicans from buying votes on Election Day. In Indiana, for example, men were paid $15 to vote for the Republican candidate. The Democrats bought votes too, but they had less money to spend than the Republicans. When the popular votes were counted, Cleveland had about 100,000 more than Harrison. But Harrison had more electoral votes. He won the election.
Grover Cleveland had mixed feelings about his defeat. He wanted to win because he believed his policies were best for the country. He said he was not sorry that he had made tariffs the major issue in the campaign. "I do not regret it," he said. "It is better to be defeated battling for an honest idea than to win by a cowardly trick." When President Cleveland and his wife left the White House, Mrs. Cleveland said goodbye to the servants. She told one of them, "I want you to take good care of all the furniture and other things in the house. I want to find everything the same when we come back 4 years from now."
The new president, Benjamin Harrison, had big political debts to repay. He understood this when he began organizing his administration. "When I came to power," Harrison said, "I found that my party's leaders had taken all the power for themselves. I could not name my own cabinet. They had sold every cabinet position to pay for the election."
The position of Secretary of State went to James Blaine, who had refused his party's requests to run for president. Blaine had served as Secretary of State under Presidents James Garfield and Chester Arthur. The position of Postmaster General went to John Wanamaker. Wanamaker had raised most of the money for Harrison's campaign. He had given $50,000 of his own money. He planned to repay party supporters with jobs in the post office department.
During the campaign, Harrison had promised to enforce the civil service law that protected the job rights of government workers. He promised that workers would be removed only in the interests of better government. Wanamaker and other party leaders criticized Harrison. They said they could not build a strong party organization without promising government jobs to voters. So President Harrison suspended the civil service laws that protected postal workers. Within a year, 30,000 Democrats were removed from the department. Their jobs went to Republicans. The president then announced that the post office would once again be protected by the civil service laws.
Former President Cleveland had been troubled by the extra money in the federal treasury. This was tax money the government collected but did not use. Most of the extra money came from high protective tariffs on imported products. Cleveland wanted to reduce the surplus by reducing the tariffs. President Harrison decided to reduce the surplus too, but he would do it by increasing government spending, not by cutting taxes. Congress agreed. It became the first Congress to spend $1,000 million.
Much of the money was spent on payments to men who had fought in the Union Army during the Civil War. These payments cost the government more than $100 million a year. Congress also approved millions of dollars for government projects in the home states of important congressmen. This was called pork barrel spending. It paid for new roads, bridges, and government buildings, for almost anything the congressman wanted. Congress reduced the surplus even more by approving money to build coastal defenses and to buy warships for the Navy.
The American Congress passed several historic pieces of legislation during Benjamin Harrison's administration.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.